It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Hey now, I watched the trial so you don't have to. And when I say watch, I'm saying it liberally because all we're getting is reporters' notes and feeds from inside the Donald Trump hush money trial. Today, the further cross-examination of David Pecker. But before we dive into that, hope you have a great weekend coming up. We are actually making changes to Media Buzz as we speak. Hope you'll get a chance to see the show, 11 a.m. Sunday morning, 11 Eastern, that is, on Fox. I've also been listening to, boy, talk about a bombshell here, Joe Biden talking to Howard Stern. And I've been saying all along, I mean, he should talk to Howard. I didn't think it'd be the other Howard. It's a pretty soft interview. It's Howard, you know, Howard's a great interviewer, but, you know, he's not exactly asking him any presidential level questions, at least what I've heard so far. All right. So the one-time publisher of the National Enquirer testifying under a grant of immunity is now being pressed by the former president's lawyer. And he's doing a pretty effective job, I must say. That is Trump's attorney. Because he got David Pecker to acknowledge that going back to the 1990s, when he was pals with Donald Trump, it was the Enquirer's policy not to run negative stories on Trump because it was bad for business. Trump was, if you had Trump on the cover or a significant Trump headline, it sold papers. And so that will enable the defense to say, look, when he didn't run any negative stories when Donald Trump became a presidential candidate in 2015 and 2016, that's not any different than he was doing all along. So where's the crime here? Pecker also acknowledging that he had what he called a mutually beneficial relationship with other celebrities. Trump wasn't the only guy he dealt with. He even described a situation where he bought some photos of Tiger Woods. I remember the Enquirer being big on breaking news about Tiger in the days when he was not only an amazing golfer, but let's just say got to know plenty of women, that he did this as leverage. In other words, we won't run the photos as long as you cooperate with us on other stuff. So that's the thing about Pecker is that, you know, the National Enquirer, which I have credited at times for doing good reporting, for example, on the story about John Edwards' mistress, never exactly a paragon of journalism, always, often, regularly paying for stories, known as checkbook journalism, paying sources off to get a scoop on things. So they talked about, in court today, the August 15th, that is August of 2015, meeting. Pecker, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump. Just a couple months after Trump declared his presidential candidacy. And much was made when the prosecutors had Pecker on the stand of running negative stories on the Clintons, because Donald loved that. Negative stories on Bill, the subject of which you can probably imagine. Negative stories on Hillary. I remember seeing one headline. Hillary's gained 103 pounds. I think that was probably an exaggeration. Perhaps they had an unflattering photo. There was an unflattering photo. Anyway, Pecker acknowledged under cross that this was beneficial to the Enquirer's parent company, American Media, because negative stories on Bill and Hillary sold well. Now, there was also this headline about Ben Carson, who was running against Donald Trump, along with Ted Cruz and a bunch of other Republicans, saying bungling surgeon Ben Carson leaves sponge in patient's brain. I didn't even know whether that was true. But apparently there was a malpractice claim against Carson. And before the Inquirer ran that headline I just described to you, Pecker acknowledging that other outlets, other media outlets, ran this case or suit or claim against Dr. Carson. And he admitted when there were negative stories about Marco Rubio, who was also running against the Donald, that those articles weren't exclusive either. Pecker saying, well, we were recycling things from other outlets. It was cost efficient to do that. By the way, to some degree, every media outlet on the planet does that. You know, somebody else has got a scoop and you run and usually you attribute. Don't know if there was any attribution going on here. But the point is, it sounded pretty bad when the Inquirer was running these pieces. You know, Ted Cruz was the worst. I mean, just some of it was just absolute fake news, made up stuff. Ted Cruz's five secret mistresses. Ted Cruz's father. And Lee Harvey Oswald plotted the JFK assassination. Just bogus, fabricated garbage. But on these other examples, Rubio, Carson, you know, here's the guy who was the publisher saying, yeah, you know, we didn't break that. We were picking it up from elsewhere. And then came the Wall Street Journal story. I mentioned this yesterday, just days before the election, which the Journal got the fact, was able to publish the fact. I'm sure the Inquirer was not thrilled about this. I know Donald Trump was not happy about this. That the National Enquirer was running positive stories about candidate Trump and negative stories about other Republican candidates. And by the way, Pecker had to acknowledge that at that meeting, Trump Tower, August the 5th, 2015, Catch and Kill, which the Inquirer later engaged in, was not discussed. Also acknowledging that Donald Trump and Michael Cohen did not pay Pecker's company for the story on the doorman. This is the former Trump doorman. He got $30,000 for peddling what turned out to be not an unsubstantiated story, a completely and totally false story that Trump had fathered a child out of wedlock. The reason the Inquirer didn't run that was tabloid did its due diligence. It wasn't true. David Pecker also acknowledging that there were hundreds of thousands of source agreements over the years. I don't know that hundreds of thousands of people were paid money, but they would come to agreements with confidential sources. And by the way, and this came out when Alvin Bragg's people had Pecker on the stand, if the doorman story had turned out to be true, in other words, if there could have been a headline, Donald Trump's love child, again, I want to stress, complete BS. No dispute about that. Trump had even offered to take a DNA test. If that had been true, Pecker said he would have run it. Would have been the biggest Inquirer story ever, he acknowledged. Then they got, basically what Trump's attorney was doing was going back. Attorney's name is Bove, Emil Bove. Going back over all the testimony and trying to either knock it down or provide other context. So, for example, there was all this stuff about Karen McDougal. And certainly Karen McDougal wanted money, and the Inquirer provided the money. And what Pecker said was that the main thing she wanted was not to have her story published. Remember, there was the quote about, I don't want to be the next Monica Lewinsky. She certainly was willing to be reimbursed. She wanted to be on a couple of magazine covers. This was all part of the agreement. But mostly she didn't want this to come out. Now, obviously, she later changed her mind. And then just one interesting aside, Michael Cohen, Trump, Pecker got a laugh out of the courtroom. I don't think he intended to be funny when asked, was he a major attorney? He says, I would not say Michael Cohen was a major attorney. He was Trump's fixer at that time before turning on him. And obviously, we'll hear from him later in the trial and his credibility having gone to jail will come under fierce attack. So Cohen was thinking of leaving and maybe going to work for Mark Cuban, the then Dallas Mavericks owner and rich guy who I've interviewed and who set up a whole network. So Cohen asked Pecker to send Donald Trump a paparazzi shot that had been taken of Cohen and Cuban just to kind of plant the seed or put a little pressure on him that Cohen was thinking maybe he's not going to stick around. Obviously, he did stick around. Obviously, looking back, he probably wishes he hadn't stuck around because of all the trouble he got into. And look, he willingly did Donald Trump's bidding, and that will become a major focus of the trial later on. So it was yesterday, after the podcast deadline, that David Pecker began talking about Stormy Daniels. And it took a couple of strange twists. So according to Pecker's account, he refused to use the National Enquirer's money to get hush money to Stormy Daniels. Remember, he had just done it for Karen McDougal, the former Playmate of the Year, and hadn't gotten reimbursed. You know, he says he has a high-minded reason for doing this. I did not want the National Enquirer to be associated with a porn star. But he also said, I am not a bank. He thought he might get stuck with the bill again. I thought Michael Cohen and Donald Trump should buy it, meaning buy the rights to Stormy or however they were going to pay her off. And Cohen began saying, every time we talk, we have to go on Signal, an encrypted conversation. And then the Wall Street Journal story hit about Karen McDougal, and they had a lot. I just went and looked it up yesterday, raising questions about her personal relationship with Donald Trump, which he continues to deny. And Pecker spoke to Trump about this article 3 days before the election. And Trump was not happy. How could this happen? I thought you had this under control. Either you or one of your people leaked the story. He was so agitated, he hung up. He didn't say goodbye. The Enquirer's parent company put out a statement denying killing any negative stories about Trump. Completely false. Pecker, I wanted to protect myself, my company, and I wanted to protect Donald Trump. Enquirer editor Dylan Howard sent a text saying, status quo, no TV mentions, meaning the election is about to happen. This is so far looks like a one-day story, and it's not a hot topic on TV. You know what it's like the last few days of election. I mean, it's just complete chaos in terms of an avalanche of stories and accusations and so forth. So then Pecker decided he was going to amend his agreement, really meaning extend it, with Karen McDougal. And Cohen told him, don't do that. The boss, Trump, would be very angry. But Pecker didn't take the advice. He hired a PR person. But by then, Trump had won the election. And then a lot of media attention, January 17th, so that's 3 days before Donald Trump's inauguration in 2016. He's having a meeting with Reince Priebus, Sean Spicer, Jim Comey, who was FBI director, Mike Pompeo. And when he got done talking to these members of his soon-to-be administration, he spoke privately to Pecker. Trump, how's our girl doing? And he thanked him for handling Karen McDougal and handling the doorman. You remember the doorman had the false story. He said the stories would have been very embarrassing. And by the way, yesterday I said, relying on reports from inside the courtroom, that Pecker didn't mention the campaign. That was not true. I later saw further reporting on it that said that, in fact, before the campaign, when Trump was worried about negative stories, he would talk about he was worried about the reaction of Melania or Ivanka. But now it looked like it was the campaign, according to Pecker's analysis here. So Trump was upset, didn't understand why this agreement with Karen McDougal had been extended. Then Pecker found out about Stormy Daniels doing an interview with Anderson Cooper on CNN. And then there was a SEC inquiry, and Pecker signed a non-prosecution agreement, meaning he admitted to certain things in exchange for immunity that he still has in his testimony. Now, take a little quick look at the coverage. A couple of polls here, interesting. CNN poll. 13% believe Donald Trump is being treated the same as other criminal defendants. 34% saying he's being treated more harshly. 34% saying he's being treated more leniently than other defendants. I mean, there's the divide in the country right there. And here's statistic number two. Finds only 44% of Americans expressing confidence that the jury in the hush money case will be able to reach a fair verdict. 56% skeptical that a fair outcome will be the ultimate result.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
And let me switch to the Supreme Court. Remember, yesterday was, you know, at the same time I had to listen to the oral arguments live from SCOTUS, but follow, you know, on the side of the screen, the reporters' notes and filings from inside the Manhattan courtroom. So Washington, New York. Anyway, when I was recording the podcast yesterday, the first half of the oral arguments ended up going more than 2.5 hours, by the way. Almost all of the justices were saying, as I reported to you, well, you know, how could a president have complete and total blanket immunity? Because what if he arranges to assassinate a political rival? What if he engages in a coup? What if he engages in election fraud? And Trump's lawyer had to sort of keep backing off. He kept making his distinction between official conduct and private conduct being something that he could be sued for. And so it certainly seemed true that they certainly were not going to go along, that the justices are certainly not going to go along with the notion that the president has immunity to, you know, call in SEAL Team 6. But in the second half of the argument, when Jack Smith's lawyer was up, Michael Dreeben, the tone changed. And here was the most telling comment from Chief Justice John Roberts, who was the one who had raised the question about, appointing an ambassador is an official act, but taking a bribe in exchange is not, and you would need to have both in an indictment. But Roberts says, why shouldn't we either send it back to the Court of Appeals or issue an opinion making clear that that's not the law? And Alito, Sam Alito, a stable democratic society requires that a candidate who loses an election, even a close one, even a hotly contested one, leave office peacefully. But criminal prosecution would make that less likely. Will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy? Anyway, one of the incentives might be for presidents to try to pardon themselves. That was Neil Gorsuch. Amy Coney Barrett, though, the last Trump appointee to SCOTUS, said that Trump's use, remember what this is about, Trump's use of a private attorney who was willing to spread knowingly false claims of election fraud was private conduct. Well, Gorsuch came back with that. What if the president leads a peaceful or mostly peaceful protest in front of Congress because he objects to a piece of legislation and that delays the proceedings in Congress? So a president could then be prosecuted for that? Certainly sounds like Gorsuch didn't think so. Anyway, it's pretty clear now, and court watchers more experienced than I am are saying that wherever the high court comes down, it's going to be sent back to the lower court, which means it's not going to be, Jack Smith will not be able to bring this case before the election, which means if Donald Trump wins the election, it's over. He will tell his attorney general to drop it, and the prosecution is toast. New York Times observing that the whole reason for spending so much time on Karen McDougal was to set it up to show that that particular payment, $150,000 to write this or put her name to this ghostwritten fitness columns, were really about getting around campaign finance laws. And when Trump spoke privately after that January 17th meeting with future cabinet members just before the inauguration, he went to Pecker and he said, "How's our girl doing?" Meaning McDougal. And there were various times when Trump was just angry at Pecker. Different phone calls, different circumstances, very angry, very aggravated. But Pecker said, "Look, I felt that Donald Trump was my mentor. I still consider him a friend." And then we got into the Arnold digression. Arnold Schwarzenegger was hired as an editor at large for the fitness magazines that Pecker had bought. And Arnold said, "The condition is you can't run any negative stories about me. I'm going to run for governor of California." And they reached a kind of a compromise. After the court sessions yesterday, Donald Trump did something interesting. He talked about the 1.6% growth in GDP, gross domestic product, and how bad that was, how anemic it was. And it was not a great number. But it shows you he's always got the campaign on his mind, even on a day when he was, A, in court in Manhattan, B, obviously following the Supreme Court oral arguments. And in an interview, he said he hadn't tried to prosecute Hillary, even though he thought she probably deserved it. And then turning to the people who are prosecuting him, "These people are radical lunatics. They don't care, and they have to be very careful with what they're doing because it comes back to bite." What is he saying there? Well, here is what Trump is saying about, let's just make this story number two, the anti-Israel and anti-Semitic protests. Trump said, "We're having protests all over," and he, Joe Biden, is talking about Charlottesville. Charlottesville was a little peanut, and it was nothing compared to the hate you have here. This is tremendous hate, again, referring to what we're seeing from the pro-Palestinian, I would say pro-Hamas, demonstrators at Columbia and elsewhere. We'll come back to that. White House Deputy Press Secretary put out a statement saying, minimizing the anti-Semitic and white supremacist poison displayed in Charlottesville is repugnant and divisive. And that Charlottesville was so important, that's why President Biden decided to run in 2020. In recent days, you've heard President Biden forcefully and repeatedly condemn horrifying anti-Semitic comments captured on video. No, you haven't. You've heard him say, you've seen a lot of statements in the White House, maybe Karine Jean-Pierre, but you haven't heard Joe Biden. All you've heard him say is, of course, I'm against the anti-Semitic protests. In a shouted question where it was hard to hear him. So that was not quite right. Meanwhile, USC has canceled its main graduation. A big flap about the valedictorian who is Muslim, has made pro-Palestinian statements. They just said this is out of control, which shows you how these protesters are winning. Columbia campus has essentially been shut down, University of Southern California now. And then in Texas, at the University of Texas at Austin, Governor Greg Abbott called in over 100 state troopers. Dozens of arrests were made. Abbott making clear he's not going to, you know, Texas was not going to be like Columbia. But he's also getting criticism because Abbott signed a law in 2019 aimed to protect free speech on college campuses by guaranteeing anyone can protest in common outdoor areas as long as they're not breaking the law or disrupting the regular functioning of the school. That's what these protesters say they were doing. But meanwhile, prosecutors dropped charges against 46 out of the 57 protesters arrested, citing deficiencies pointed out by their lawyers. Also, poll by the Kennedy School. Now, this took place in March before the explosion in these protests at college and university campuses across the country. And also, it's among young voters defined as 18 to 29, which means most of them are not college students. I mean, usually you're in college from 17 or 18 to 21 or 22, but this goes all the way up to 29. Anyway, not great news for Joe Biden because his approval rating among young voters, 31%. He's still up on Trump, but by a much smaller margin than you would expect. Handling of the Israel-Hamas conflict, 18% approval among younger people. And, but this is interesting, Israel and Palestine, the 15th most important issue. The top to the younger people, inflation, healthcare, housing, gun violence, and jobs. And then this sort of real split decision here. 21% say Israel's response to the Hamas atrocities are justified. 32% say not justified. 45% say they just don't know. Interesting. All right, this shows you what a crazed news environment this is, because I couldn't even get to this yesterday. But story three, Harvey Weinstein's conviction on felony sex charges in New York overturned by the state's highest court. Now, let me hasten to add, there's no practical effect because he is in prison in California, where in a separate case, he was found guilty of rape. So it's not like Harvey Weinstein gets to walk free. But this, of course, started or turbocharged the whole Me Too movement. 4-3 ruling by the Court of Appeals said the judge in the case made a mistake by allowing prosecutors to call as witnesses a series of women who said Weinstein had assaulted them, but those accusations were not part of the charges. They were sort of like these backup witnesses. Well, that was a dumb move because it ended up invalidating the conviction. doesn't mean he's innocent, but it's not just a technicality. And if the judge hadn't done that, we wouldn't have this overturning of the conviction. A little background here. We will do everything in our power to retry this case, says the Manhattan DA's office. That's now Alvin Bragg. At the time of the Weinstein prosecution, it was Cy Vance Jr. Decision was disheartening news for Weinstein's accusers. Here's a dissent from one of the justices on the New York Supreme Court, or the state's highest court, I should say. Men who serially sexually exploit their power over women, especially the most vulnerable groups in society, will reap the benefits of the decision, says the dissent. All right, story four is that Politico has this huge look at tensions between the Biden campaign and the New York Times. Now, a lot of this may seem like inside baseball, but, you know, many people probably think, well, you know, Times, liberal newspaper, and Joe Biden's the Democratic president. But they just don't get along. So just to give you some of this, Washington bureau chief Elizabeth Buemiller didn't like the way a couple of the Times staffers talked to her about a particular complaint. And when that, when one of those staffers tried to bring up a second concern, she just hung up. The principal deputy press secretary for Biden then emailed Buemiller saying, you've got to reaffirm your commitment to abiding by the rules on background. A reporter who's not that familiar with D.C. made a mistake and attributed something that was supposed to be on background on the record. That's not nothing, but it's not exactly, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that Buemiller then never responded. And so what happened is the Times was penalized by the Biden White House, taken off the tier one email list for background information about briefings and other material, and it stayed that way for 11 months. So the relationship remains tense. Complaints are spilling into public view. The president's press flacks, says this piece, might bemoan what they see as the entitlement of Time staffers. But they themselves put the newspaper on the highest of pedestals, given its history, stature, and unparalleled reach. And yet they see the Times falling short in a make-or-break moment for American democracy, and often sort of blurring the differences between Donald Trump and his candidacy and Joe Biden's candidacy. Here's Kate Berner, who had been Biden's deputy White House communications director. Democrats believe in the importance of a free press in upholding our democracy, and the New York Times was for generations an important standard bearer for the Fourth Estate. The frustration with the Times is sometimes so intense, she says, because the Times is failing at its important responsibility. Biden aides largely view the election as an existential choice for the country. Some Times reporters, and this is the kind of stuff that goes on in every campaign, but particularly intense here, found themselves cut off by sources after publishing pieces the Bidens and top aides didn't like. You used to hear about that with the Trump campaign and the Trump White House. Maureen Dowd, perhaps the paper's most prominent columnist, complained to colleagues that she stopped hearing from White House officials after writing a column about Hunter Biden. Elizabeth Buemiller, in an interview with Politico, they're not being realistic about what we do for a living. You can be a force for democracy, liberal democracy. You don't have to be a force for the Biden White House. And so the Times is also ticked off because they were notified of certain things, like Biden's first public appearance after announcing his candidacy at a pizzeria in Wilmington. Biden aides still hold a grudge. But now, there's been a reaction. Oh, let me just first quote Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent, does a terrific job in my view, and is often on MSNBC. Every White House I've covered complains about our coverage. Says Peter, it comes with the territory, but because of Trump, there's this new assumption that the New York Times and other media are supposed to put their thumb on the scale and take sides, and we don't do that. And Buemelo says, Elizabeth Buemelo, we haven't been tough enough on Trump. I mean, give me a break. Have they read our coverage? I don't have to go through all the things we have covered on Trump. We just do our jobs. Oh, another point of contention is that every president since FDR has done an interview with the New York Times, not the Biden presidency. By the way, nor has he done a sit-down interview with the Washington Post, nor has he done a sit-down interview with the Wall Street Journal. So, and so since this piece was published, the Times put out a statement saying it's outrageous and untrue to say that, you know, our coverage was affected by the fact that we have that the paper hasn't been able to get an interview. The Times says that Biden not sending for an interview is avoiding scrutiny and accountability. It's not like the president gives a whole lot of interviews to any but friendly interlocutors. The notion that any line of coverage, says this statement, has been ordered up or encouraged in retaliation for declining an interview is outrageous and untrue. The publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, had raised the request for an interview. I think this was with a conversation with Kamala Harris. And so here's Baker again responding to the piece, Peter Baker. A.G. Sulzberger, wants us to cover this president and every president as fully, fairly, and aggressively as we can because that's our role. That's true regardless of whether we get an interview. A.G. is a complete straight shooter.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
All right, let's wrap up with number five as we head into the weekend. The Athletic has a piece about Caitlin Clark. And don't start with me about, you're obsessed with Caitlin Clark and so forth. I just cover the news. This isn't actually a story about her incredible basketball skills. It's a story about money and celebrity. And it talks about, I think I mentioned some days ago, I guess it's now final, and she's got a $28 million endorsement deal with Nike. So the fact that she's only getting a $75,000 salary from the WNBA, kind of beside the point. So The Athletic says, we should not delude ourselves into believing that her appeal as an influencer is based solely on basketball, because it's not. Arguing otherwise is an affront to history and reality. Clark's attractiveness to local companies and national corporations is heightened by the fact that she is a white woman who has dominated a sport that's viewed as predominantly black, a straight woman who is joining a league with a sizable LGBTQ plus player population, and a person who comes from America's heartland, where folks often feel that their beliefs and values are ignored or misunderstood. So, you can't separate these things, says The Athletic. It's the Caitlin Clark effect. Is basketball a major factor? Of course. The racial component when discussing brand ambassadors may make people uncomfortable. Sue Bird, who is white and gay and one of the legends of women's basketball, addressed this in 2020 when she said the following. Even though we're female athletes playing at a high level, our worlds, the soccer world and the basketball world, just totally different. And to be blunt, it's the demographic. Women's soccer players are generally cute little white girls, while WNBA players, we are all shapes and sizes, a lot of black, gay, tall women. There is maybe an intimidation factor. People are quick to judge and put it down. So I think you may agree, you may disagree, but I think that's a pretty candid discussion. So Once again, I hope you have a great weekend. Media Buzz, 11 a.m. Eastern on Fox News Channel. Hope you'll catch the show. We're going to deal with a lot of these topics. Campus protests, Trump, you name it. And we'll see you back here Monday with more Buzz Meter.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.